Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
Welcome to Volume 88 in the Brecan What's On Information Sessions, a series of talks produced for people with a gynecological or breast cancer, their families and friends. This session was recorded on the 12th of June 2013 in the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, located in Melbourne's CBD. In this session, Dr. Carrie Lethberg talks about the many issues common to women who have completed cancer treatment, and she discusses strategies to assist recovery, goal setting, and learning to live with uncertainty. We hope you enjoy this session.
So a couple of things, do interrupt me if you want to. At little points, I've got some questions for you to think about yourself, and if anyone wants to share their thoughts about it as we go through, but you don't have to, you can take them away and think about them, but do stop me also if you want to. This topic, we did a study on treatment completion, it must be 15 years ago, and it continues to be as big an issue as it was then. And I think that's partly because we don't do well enough in the those who are working in the treatment areas in terms of preparing you for this next phase. But the first thing I want to say is that the fact that it is an issue of what do you do when treatment is finished is a fantastic thing. However, we need to be preparing you and better supporting you in this space. So the fact that we have so many people who get through treatment and go on is a wonderful thing. It's just that we need to do that things better. Okay. Cancer survivorship is a term that is, I think, a very American term. A lot of people that I work with don't really like it. And there's a whole lot of literature about whether you are a survivor from the moment that you're diagnosed or whether it starts when treatment's finished or 5 years later or whatever. I don't know that it's so helpful. One of the things I'm going to ask you to think about is what would you call yourself now, a bit later on. But I think that this is more about a transition. It's about living through an experience and recovering from that experience as you've gone through. So there's theory around transition, and for anyone that goes through a major transition, the theory is the same, really. A life transition is initiated when a person's current reality is disrupted, which is the big understatement today, that your reality is disrupted when you're suddenly faced with a cancer diagnosis. You're going along, you have a whole lot of beliefs about the world, about luck, about your health, about who's going to be there if something bad happens. What your plans are, what your goals are, and all of that is disrupted by this experience. So the process of transition involves bridging the gap between what you knew and this new reality. And I often use the analogy of crossing a bridge, and this painting is actually of a blind woman crossing a bridge, and I think that might even be more accurate. And this process is you're standing at the start of this bridge. You have no choice but to cross it, which is one of the really unfortunate things. And you have to cross this bridge and you leave what you knew. And you need to cross it in this experience of cancer to get to the other side. And when you're in this bit in the middle, it's really uncomfortable because you are, it's full of uncertainty. You just have to keep taking what everyone tells you you have to do next. It's a very uncomfortable place to be. But to acknowledge that that's where you are, you're in this process of transition, is somewhat useful than just going, I don't know what I think about anything anymore. So this study that we did, I was trying to think last night when we did it, because it was a long time ago, but I think it still really stands true. And so I'm going to give you the results of what came out of the study now, to give you a bit of an idea of how we've developed our thinking at St Vincent's around post-treatment issues. So this was a fairly simple study. We interviewed women who had finished treatment for early stage breast cancer They were about 6 weeks after their last treatment, and we also interviewed whoever they wanted to declare was their significant other. So for some, it was a female partner, some it was a male partner, some it was a close friend. So I'm going to give you mostly just the results from the women, but I'm going to tell you a little bit of really useful stuff about what the partner said as well. So when we said, tell us what this experience has been like and what it's like now when we're finished, everyone needed to go back and tell us what happened at 9 months. That's really common. Telling the story is really important, especially when you've been through trauma, because every time you tell it, you process it. You hear yourself saying it, and you process it, and that's part of dealing with trauma. So that was no surprise to us that that's what people wanted to talk about. So the first stage was the diagnosis experience, and the transition was from being a well person to suddenly being a cancer patient in the blink of an eye. And the experience was described as absolute shock. The descriptions were quite amazing. This moment of life changing, that moment when you heard the word or whatever it was, and you didn't hear anything else afterwards, and real bewilderment. What does this mean for me? And the task then was to manage this shock and at the same time make a whole lot of decisions about treatment and appraise exactly what this means for my life. And what do we know about shock is that you shouldn't make any decisions when you're in shock, but of course you have to. So a couple of quotes. It was one of those moments that will live on in life. It's scary. I hope I never have that moment again when she tells me it's cancer. And another said she described the scene like a photographic still, the crying, the feeling of tears. Mum was at the end of the bed and she burst out crying and ran. And people often describe it like they're watching it. You're watching yourself in a really bad movie. And that's part of shock because you actually have to remove yourself because you're trying to cope with this horrific situation. And I think we really downplay what an impact certain moment, wherever it was. You know, for some women, that moment takes a month of actually getting diagnosed, and for others, it's like, I was fine and then I was giving this news. Okay, then there was talk about the treatment experience. So you're in this good transition phase that you're right in the world of being a cancer patient. The experience is about just getting through. Can't actually think about much else. I have just got to get through this experience. And an experience, when you ask women to really describe it, of psychological and physical trauma. And if you read about other traumas that people have been through, they say the same kind of thing. This is a major trauma that happens to you, is done to you during this time. So the adjustment task is about managing this new world, learning to live with uncertainty, adapting to all these changes, physical and emotional changes, and of course, I think especially for women, coping with the impact on others and seeing people that you love worried and crying and upset is really hard. But also having people in the house that aren't normally in the house, and food or you know, whatever it is, it's all very different. But often what happens is that the way you cope internally is actually avoiding. And this is a useful process, very useful process, about survival. That one woman said she was like a racehorse with on. I know all this stuff is happening over here. I'm aware of it. I know that there's a threat, but I actually cannot look at it right now because I've got to get through treatment. Treatment's pretty horrible. It was awful. It was as bad or worse than I ever expected it to be. Each time you have a dose of chemotherapy, it takes longer for your body to get better. I just really couldn't see it ending. Now, I'm very aware that people have very different experiences of chemotherapy, and some of you might not have chemotherapy. Whatever it was for you, it's generally scary. During treatment, and this is part of this blinkering, you're in go-forward mode, eyes on the prize of the end. I didn't stop to think about what's really happening to me. Again, that's a really normal response to a traumatic situation. And then treatment finished. So the transition phase then is from cancer patient to, I'm not sure, one of the big things, what do you call yourself now, but we'll say survivor, because that's the term in the literature at the moment. The experience is forced relief, but we all know it's really mixed with ambivalence and fear. The really interesting thing for me in doing this study was the moment when I got this next bit, that this is when the women were starting to process what happened to them. And again, I went back and read accounts of other traumatic experiences, and I remember reading one book about a couple that were lost in the desert, a really horrific story, and the woman said she was lying in bed the night after they had been found, and she was in the lovely bed, she was safe, and she lay down and she went, oh my God, what just happened to us? That was the first time she was able to really look at the hell that she had been through. Because she was safe enough away from the threat, that initial threat, diagnosis or being lost in the desert, to start going, now I can look at it. Okay, so that's when the processing could start. And so the adjustment is adapting to any changes that have come up for you. So if you believed in a particular thing and that was really challenged by this experience, now what do you believe in? Changes of values, attitudes and expectations, constructing a new reality, what life's going to be like for you now, looking back and appraising and trying to start looking forward at developing new goals, if you feel you can do that. So Claire said, I could do cartwheels down the street. Gail said, I told my doctor, doctor, that's it, I'm not coming here anymore, it's just so really great. But Annie said, whereas at the time of going through treatment, the time of being operated on and having all of that, it was a time when I didn't really think I even really had cancer. That does not surprise me. Too hard to even really accept that word in your mind. Looking back, I think it's a bit unreal, whereas now it's becoming real. So, this is not an easy one to read, sorry, but this is giving you what I've just shown you in a table. So the phases I've just explained are diagnosis, treatment, treatment completion, the experience I've just described, but for us, in a day oncology service, we looked at, so what are we doing at each of those phases? Well, at diagnosis, you pretty much have most of the supports are thrown at you. Far too many, probably. Too much information, you meet everyone, you meet too many people, there's a lot of things. But four resources are there when we have someone who's newly diagnosed. And then during treatment, it's a monitoring process. From a psychosocial point of view, I will be relying mostly on my team, so I don't do a whole lot of this anymore, but on the nurses to let me know if someone was really not travelling well and needed some extra support. But there is that kind of monitoring. But then when treatment was finished, we were on to the next woman who'd just been diagnosed, really, in terms of support. And in fact, before we did this study, we would do a kind of a celebratory thing when you finish treatment. The nurses would make a big deal on the last day, and various different things were done to say, yay, the last day of treatment is not exciting. And when we first started getting these results through, the nurses said, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to say you did a great job, but let me tell you that there might be some things, this is not the end of our support for you, and there might be some things that come up, and we're here. We're still here for you, and it might be in a few weeks' time or a couple of months' time. And blessings have been that we've had a number of women who have come back and said, you know, when the nurse said that to me on that last day, I thought, oh my God, I've finished treatment, I'm really happy, and now she's telling me that things will go on. I don't know why she's doing that, but I was so glad because I remembered. And now I'm feeling like I need to talk through some of this stuff, and I remember she said that's normal. So that was a good thing. Now, the interesting thing is what the partner said. And I'm sure that there are some support people here today. Thank you so much for coming. One of the things I want to say to you is that I believe that people that are very close to someone who has cancer is as traumatized by the experience as the person with cancer. It's different, but it's the same. And we have to acknowledge that and be better at supporting and preparing support people. Bad breaks looking on. So what you've got here is the phases I just explained, the experience that the women said, and this is the experience that the partner said. So at diagnosis, they said they were absolutely in shock. The speed, probably if you could measure shock as their partner, as their patient's view, excuse me, using that term for the next one. They had shock and bewilderment, but very quickly started to think, okay, what does this mean? What are we going to tell the kids? Am I going to take on more work, or will I have to pull back on work, or immediately going into what am I going to do about, how am I going to be the support person? And then during treatment, where the women were just going through this, the partners were very focused, more focused than any other time on the practical stuff, and answering the phone and telling everyone what's happening constantly. There was a sense of helplessness. We're not great at supporting people and telling people how to do that bit. Exhaustion. Their own existential issues. So starting to think, okay, what's life really about and what is our future, and those things were starting to hit them then. Certainly a sense of isolation and pacing through their own trauma. And one guy in the study, I remember, was a marathon runner, and he said, it was like when you run a marathon, you have to pace yourself through because you know it's going to take you this long, so you get your energy and you pace it so you can get to the end. And so they were using their energy to the point where treatment finished and then it was all going to be okay. And that's why they put all their energy into that period. But of course, treatment finished and the women were just starting to deal with it. And so there, they had relief, but it was tempered with a real disappointment that it's not over yet. She's actually crying now more than she cried during treatment. Or she's more upset, or she now doesn't know what she's going to go back to work, or whatever it actually is. So there's a tension, and when I'm referred couples, most commonly it's at this point. Tension over, isn't it time we got back to normal? And the women go, you know what? I don't know what normal is anymore. And I don't know that I can do that. And I'm really sorry. And I know we've just been through this really hard time. But we've still got a bit of a way to go. Does this resonate with any of you?
Yes.
Does anyone want to tell me any bits about why it resonates? You don't have to, but. Which is how men are taught to cope with things. So women, even from little girls, are taught about, you know, you respond emotionally, and men are taught that you need to fix it and make it better, which is a really unenviable place to be when you're in this situation. But it can work. It can work very well in terms of the support business. But what we have to remember is what that actually means that man is carrying, because he's trying to make it all okay. And there's so much uncertainty that that's enormous. Okay, thank you for that. So summary for this bit. Living through the experience of diagnosis and treatment for breast cancer has many similarities with living through any traumatic experience. I often use the term trauma, you've been through a trauma, because I think we underplay that enormously. And if you need permission that you are still fatigued, that you still find it hard to go into crowds of people, that you're not sure who you want to see, whatever it is, you have been through a major trauma. And if you've been in a plane crash, you probably give yourself more permission of, yeah, I'm still recovering from that, than you do, I think, when you've been through this experience. While a person is in the middle of a traumatic experience, they are seldom able to focus on the experience themselves because you are surviving. You are in survival mode. Rather, they use the use of diversion and avoidance of common coping mechanisms for managing trauma. A major aspect of the survivorship experience following trauma relates to the residual impact of the experience that was avoided. What's left over, what still needs to be done. So these are some questions that I want you to think about for yourself. You can tell me what your answer is now or even later if you want, or you can just take it home with you. Because it's useful when you're doing that processing. What was the hardest thing about your experience? And can I say, if you have partner or children or whoever who went through this with you, I ask this of everyone who went through it, because their hardest thing is as legitimate as yours was. And it's interesting what the hardest thing is, because sometimes we think, oh, it's chemotherapy or it's hearing you have cancer or fear or whatever. But actually, it's quite often that a couple of my friends who were dear to me weren't there. And that broke my heart in the middle of everything else, or whatever it is. So the question of what was the hardest thing for you will give you an idea of what the recovery, your recovery is about. What was the biggest surprise? What we know is that there are lots of positives that come out of this experience as well. Can I say you are very welcome to have copies of this as well? You're welcome to take photos of it and subscribe it as well. But if you want copies, that's fine. What was the biggest surprise? There's often some amazing surprises. I learned how to say no. No, I'm not going to do that extra thing. I learned how loved I was. I learned how strong I was, whatever it is. And then this one, I think, is an interesting one, and I'd love to hear any responses now to this. How would you describe yourself in relation to cancer? Are you someone who has cancer? Are you someone who has cancer? Are you a cancer survivor? Or are you something else? Does anyone want to tell me what you would call yourself now? And I know that there are, you're all at different stages probably in this room. Wasn't that comfortable with the idea of survivor, but now I feel comfortable with it. I think that I would say it's a very personal thing about when it does feel okay to say that, to say what it is. And this is something that we have to discuss when we have, not just, but especially younger women who are single and whether they, how they describe themselves when they're meeting new people. Hi, I had cancer, or I'm a cancer survivor, or I have cancer, or whatever it is. Anyone else want to tell me what they think?
I don't really know. I finished my treatment the end of November, and I think I've a lot stronger going through my treatment than what I am now. I'm feeling very lost now, and I think that people, it's like I don't have attention on me.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Does anyone else feel like they were stronger during treatment than they were afterwards? Can you put your hand up for Brendan to see?
Oh,
okay. Thank you.
That was
you. Okay, you were stronger. You were surviving through treatment. It's what you did, what you had to do. And you're not weaker afterwards, you're starting to deal with the hard work of it, of what it means for me. Okay? So take that home with you, Rebecca.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Someone over here, I think, put their hand up. Yeah. Thank you. So it's really personal, and it's got to fit right with you. And so taking that question home and having to think about, well, what would I call myself now, or how do I describe it? For me, and that may change a bit down the track too. It's just useful because, you know, what happens when you're going through something is you don't really stop and go, what does this mean for me? And so part of that thinking, this gives you some framework to start doing that. Okay, so what now? What we know is that there are lots of ongoing issues to negotiate. It's common to experience ongoing physical and psychological changes after treatment completion, which needs to be negotiated. And I use the term recovery a lot. I'm recovering. And this is the things I need to do to recover, physically, psychologically, and socially. But I think that the biggest challenge is dealing with uncertainty, what I hear, in an ongoing way. What's going to happen in the future? I'll give you a couple of quotes. And I shouldn't say your name now being paid, but you.
I don't mind, truly.
Brenda personify this very well. You start to worry a bit more now. This is the time when you start to think, gosh, that happened to me, and an event gives you a bit of a jolt. Something happens, you've got a sore neck, you get a chest infection, whatever it is. Occasionally I do have the odd worries to me, and then I sort of get a little bit panicky. And I think, gosh, there's nothing being pumped into me anymore. It's my body has stopped what might be growing. A really common thought. So this analogy of the bridge, I take it one step further and say one of the hard things is not knowing what's on the other side of that bridge. One of the other analogies I often use is when this is too scary, and not knowing what is all the way there at the other end, if you can think of a microscope, so when you look through a microscope you can pull it back and you can go forward. So you go closer to the thing or you can pull right back and see that. When this feels too panicky, you come right back to right now. So I feel comfortable, I know what's going to happen this afternoon. I know what's going to happen this week, I've got plans, I feel comfortable planning for this week. We've got a holiday planned in 2 months' time and I feel fine about that. So if it's too scary to go, what's going to happen in 5 years' time, then I'm here to tell you I don't know what's going to happen in 5 years' time to me either. So what I say is you pull right back to how comfortable, what time period do I feel comfortable? And I plan for that. I pull back to what I feel okay thinking about. The other thing that can be really useful, and we don't have time to do this as a complete lesson today, but I will go through some of the steps here, is learning how to challenge automatic negative thoughts. So there's a whole body of therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, and it's really powerful in terms of learning how to live with uncertainty. Because it teaches you how to take those thoughts that feel enormous and bring them back and challenge them and put them in their place. So let me give you the example of Mary. So Mary is 6 months having finished treatment and she's feeling pretty good and she's having days where she's not self-conscious thought about cancer very much. And she gets up one morning and she's sitting in the sun, she's reading the paper, and as there seems to be every single day after you're diagnosed, there's an article about breast cancer in the paper, and it's got some statistics in it, and she reads it, and she doesn't actually really acknowledge, but after that she's flicking the paper, and then she goes and she does the washing up, she's throwing the dishes down. Her mood has changed. She's tense. Shoulders are sore, she's getting a bit of a headache, someone reads and she snaps at them. Now, if she was coming to see me that afternoon and she explained that to me, I'd say, let's go back. When did you start to feel like that? And often it happens that you actually don't acknowledge the point at which it was. Someone said something to you that says, gee, but you look good. You hate that? We talk and she goes back and she goes, oh no, I think it happened, I was reading the paper. Is there something in the paper? Oh, there was that thing about breast cancer. What did you think? Now, asking what you think sounds simple, but it's actually tricky because often it happens so quickly that we don't kind of acknowledge what we thought at the time. So it takes a bit of practice to do this. So you go right back, come on, try and, what was the thought that went through your mind? I'm never going to get away from it. I have a couple of days where I haven't thought about it and then it's in front of me again. I'm never going to get away from it. So then what we would teach Mary to do is to challenge that. Challenge what she knows to be true about that. So, and this of course also comes up when you have a sore shoulder and you are sure that it's a bone secondary. And I would do the same thing. So you have these questions. What's the evidence that supports this thought? Okay, well, my arm's been sore. How long's it been sore for? Well, since I was doing Garden Hell Weekend. Okay, so there might be a particular reason, a good reason, why your arm's sore. Are there any errors in your thinking? Well, in that case, it might be certainly not jumping to the conclusion that it's the bone secondary, you've got a sore arm, it quite possibly could have been to do with the gardening. So let's note that. Okay? Is there an alternative point of view? It could be doing gardening. What's the worst or best thing that can happen? That's an important one to ask because sometimes the fear of the worst thing that can happen makes it much worse than it could be. So sometimes you have to actually say it. What if it's more cancer? What is the effect or consequences on my thinking? Is this particular thought helpful to me in my situation? So if you think of Mary who every time she reads a paper and gets upset again, that's not going to help her. She needs to put that in its place. What can I do? So in the case of the sore shoulder, first of all, you put it in its place. Could well be because of the gardening. First time it's happened, other than it could be you're saying, I have a headache every week at the moment, okay? That's something we need to keep an eye on. The shoulder needs to be kept an eye on too. So what are we going to do? We're going to look at it again on Friday. If it's still sore and anti-inflammatories aren't working, then you're going to make an appointment with your doctor and just get it sorted out. But if it's clearly that you were digging and you're pretty sure it's probably that, then I need to go, I need to put that in its place. And I need to do that as obvious a way as this is. So the way you learn out how to do this is we actually have written material where we get people to score how badly they feel and write down exactly what they were doing and exactly what their thought was. And you do it like that for a while, and then after a while it becomes second nature. So I use this all the time for myself, and I might be going, why am I feeling in such a bad mood? Well, it was because actually I started to feel it when I bumped into that person who always makes me feel ugly or fat or something. And that's crazy, and I talk myself through it, and I do it automatically now. I stop and go when you don't start feeling it. So this might sound like, well, that's, you're talking about really deep stuff like cancer coming back, how are you going to put that in its place? This really works. It really works. You start by doing it in a really clunky way like this, and after a while, it's an immediate thing. Why am I suddenly tense? It's because of this. Do I need to do something about it? Yes, then do it. Don't sit on this for another week and feel really upset and get upset with everyone around me. Or if I don't need to do something about it, I need to distract myself and put it aside and look at it again tomorrow or whatever I need to do. The other example, common example, is when you've got another medical visit or a scan or something. We all know that that day before or 2 days before, we get tense around that time. And again, it's about going through these things. Can't do anything about it. I'm going to get some result one way or another. And I know what I'm going to do with whatever that result is. So there is a whole lot, I should have a couple of websites point you, there's a whole lot on the internet about DBT. There's a lot of psychologists are great at teaching this. We should be teaching it more. We should be teaching our kids in school actually, but it's an important thing to do. The living with uncertainty is really tough. Okay. So recovery. It gives you some quotes to see whether this resonates with you. One of the things that I often hear about, again, this is a post-traumatic thing, is a loss of confidence. It can be in specific situations. A common one is being in crowds. You know, I find generally that being in crowds is hard, but whatever it is for you. I had everything planned and it was going well, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, this happened. So this is why your confidence gets thrown. You put new things and suddenly it's thrown up the air. I'm not quite as confident as I used to be. So that's sort of those sorts of things we need recovery from. Physical recovery, I sort of get recurrent minor sore throats and things, more so than person used to. They're very annoying, but I understand my body went through a lot, so I obviously have to be careful and be nurturing with myself and try to get my strength back. And we know that when we do studies of this, fatigue remains one of the big ones. If we said to you the day after you were diagnosed that the worst part's going to be that you're going to feel tired for a long time, you'd go, I'm feeling tired. That's fine until you've had it for a month on end. And there's a fine line between feeling tired and feeling low. Because you don't feel like getting up and going and doing it, so motivation goes down. Fatigue is very real. We still don't really understand why it happens. but it's real, and it needs to be clearly stated to people around you who say, well, you know, that was 6 months ago, why isn't that here? Do the things you already used to do. Your body is recovering. Social recovery. And I've heard this mentioned this afternoon as well. Once treatment finishes, the support starts to wind down fairly quickly. I suppose that's it. I'm just on my own, cast adrift. It is a fact that we build it up so that when treatment finishes, the focus on you does shift, and people do get on with their lives. And more so than that, there's a willing that things can be back to normal in the house. Please, because this has been really hard. And that's really tough, because if you're at that point where you're actually doing that processing and still recovering, you find it really hard and it feels like no one cares anymore. It's not that, it's that we set it up like, you know, just at that point where you probably need to process this with people around you, we go, well, your treatment's finished, well done, be happy, feel really good about yourself. This one from a partner who said, when she completed treatment, I thought it was all over. Like, everything that's happened so far, every stage has been a bigger surprise than the one before. I just realised that her problems really are only just starting. It isn't over. Now, I don't agree necessarily with Craig that the problems are just starting. This is not to say, guess what? You've still got all this really hard stuff. What I'm wanting to do is to normalise that if you are still coping with things, of course you are, and that you will move through this as well. It's too will come. But it makes sense that they can still open this. So one of the questions for you to think about is, what areas do you still need to go through recovery about from your cancer experience? Actually, stop and say that. Is there anything, and for some of you there will be lots of things, that you need to recover from? Is it that you've been through psychological trauma and you would feel better talking to someone about that, then do that for yourself. If it's that you are physically exhausted and you need a break, then work out how you can do that. If there are unsaid things between you and people that you love, and that is there every time you see them, then process that and do something about that. If this has raised things for you about what you do next with your life or what's important to you, then do something about that. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what's meaningful in life in a minute. For each of you, it'll be different, but it's good to stop and go, okay, I'm at this point now, what do I still need to do for me? This is the bit where maybe I take control, because a whole lot of things were done to you from that point where you were diagnosed. You had to just do what you were told and go through treatment and whatever it was. What else do you need to do for yourself? Okay, so can I ask you all to stand up and stretch? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I want to just move on to this is my next focus of study. For the last couple of years, I've been researching the importance of meaning in life, and I think this is a really great thing to be thinking about in this very stage that you are in. So when I talk about meaning in life, for me I talk about two different parts of meaning. One is what we call the cognitive meaning. How do I make sense of things? How do I make sense of the fact that cancer happened to me or to my family? Can I put it in its place? So making sense of things. And the other is the existential things. What are the things that got me up in the morning? What are the things that bring me joy? What are the things that move me? And my next question is, how can you have more of that in your life? Because if ever there was a wake-up call to stop and go, what's really important is having cancer happen to you. And so if there is one good thing that can come out of that, it's that most of us walk around sleepwalking, really. We really do. We are so busy and tired and rushing, that the things that are really important to us often aren't the things that we're spending most of our time doing or being around or whatever it is. I grew up on the northwest coast of Tasmania, right on a beach, and so when I walk down to a beach, I immediately feel better. I have an affinity with being at the ocean. I now live in North Auckland. There are no beaches in here. Now, I know that on a cognitive level, I know that if I'm really stressed and exhausted and I go down to the beach, I feel better. But I often don't do it because I'm so busy. And that crazy way to live, when I am surrounded by people who are facing what you've all faced, crazy for me to not take that and remind myself, I do try to remind myself. Okay, so meaning in life is incredibly important. And often people who aren't around people that have experienced cancer find it hard to believe that you can be in the enormous challenge that people have all faced and still have joy, joyous moments. But of course I've worked in this area for 20 years and I know when people say, no, it's not. It's because all of you will have had those moments where you immediately knew what was important in life. Immediately knew in the blink of an eye. I'll read this for Tartary. I used to use a lot of Moonix cartoons, and then I was asked to go and speak in the States, and I thought I probably should have permission to use his work. So I sent him an email, and I was told by the Age that he may get a response, he may not, might be positive, hope for peace. So I sent him an email and I said, this is Lunig, I just want to let you know I use your cartoon thing, I love my talks, and I'm wanting to, get permission to do it, and I'm doing a whole work on meaning and cancer, and these are some of the particular ones that I'd like to use. I should show you because it is framed, his response is framed on that. He said, Carrie, meaning and cancer, I cannot imagine a more important thing to talk about. You can use any of my cartoons for any of your talks from here on in.
Wow.
That's my claim to fame. Okay. Yes. So this is one of the ones that I think is really important to explain what I mean by meaning, because it's ordinary stuff. It's not that I find Malcolm Bielko. He talks about seven types of ordinary happiness. Secret happiness, which is steady but beautifully delicate, just that sense of peace that is lovely and often fleeting. 3 minutes of happiness borrowed from a dog. How many dog lovers do we have in the audience? Yep. So you know when you open the door and you come home. It's our dog is hilarious because she's just like, oh my God, I thought I'd never see you again. and then you go out to the post box and you come back and she goes, oh my God, I thought I'd never see you again. Or it might be a cat or whatever it is. But that joy of that unconditional love. The traditional lying down happiness, for those of us that are working mothers, that would be one of mine. But that sense of just give it all up. The happiness comes from that happiness which comes from staring at a rock or a sunset or an amazing tree when all the leaves are coming off it or whatever it is, all of you have probably got your eyes in all the beautiful places that you can see. Happiness blended with a mysterious sadness, that sense of, I've actually been through some big stuff. And I know that the world is not black and white, and there's that just that knowing. The strange happiness associated with being a meteorite or a shooting star or some really incredible thing. And actually this is one of my favourite ones. The diffused residual happiness resulting from the rhythmic domestic tasks such as washing the dishes. You shock, Matthew. Because my life is really frantic and for me there's something meditative about doing housework. And when you do the dishes and you finish and you put everything away and you wipe the sink down and you stand back and you take control and it feels like something is done. So when I talk about meaning, it's often not about the really big enormous thing. And when I think about the question of, what would you miss if everything was taken away from you? is probably certain people in your life. But it's also the other things that make us feel good. A good cup of tea that that one of the volunteers made me was a really good cup of tea, not just coffee. A bath, when we travel overseas a lot, we come back to be able to turn the tap on and have another water. You know, those kinds of things. They're just sitting with people that you love and feeling like there's nothing else to do tonight, we're just going to be here. Whatever it is, but those things are, that's the richness of life. And actually we should be filling our lives with those things. And it's different for everyone. And so that's really important. So one of the things I often do when I'm working with people is to start by asking them, you know, what's meaningful to you, what brings you joy, what gets you through hard times, tell me about it. Or often I'll see when someone's telling you that about their grandchildren, and you see them just light up. No, tell me more about what that feels like. This came from a dinner party at my house when we went through our list. What does that bring you joy? New pajamas, holding your hand, an afternoon in the garden with friends, sailing on a sunny day, the trees outside our bedroom window, undying friendship, and an old favourite, which is the tin roof, the rain on the roof. You know, these might sound like little toy things, but they're actually not. And when you've been through trauma, these are the things that really bring you so much joy. And when we talk about this at the hospital, we talk about how can you bring these things into the hospital. If someone says to me, I think it's in the sky, if there's a way we can get them a bed by the window, I see that as one of the bigger dimensions that I can do. In one of the other talks I get is titled, Is Smuggling a Dog into a Hospital a Social Work Intervention? Yes, it is. It's not legal. I'm not admitting to anything in particular, but it might have been the most important thing I could have done for a particular older single lady who wanted to get discharged and didn't want to stay in hospital any longer. The fact that the dog might have fitted into a bag quite easily, and that the nursing staff were wonderful at helping us, if we had done it, get through the back lift. Of all the things we could have done for her, we could have sedated her, we could have shackled her, we could have done a whole lot of things, but bringing her dog in was the most meaningful thing we could do, and that's made all the difference. Yes. And let's think about why that would restore her faith in human nature. It was an act of kindness. It was going out of our way, although my feeling is that we do whatever it takes, is what I tell my team. You do whatever it takes. I don't care if it's not on your dog's fiction. You do whatever it takes. But one of the big reasons why that might restore her faith is because she knew that we got her. And that's something that we all, gosh, we so desperately need to feel like we belong and we matter for who we are. And in the therapy that we've done, the meaning-based therapy that we've been doing, and we do it with people with really advanced disease, one of the really common things that comes out of that are the people who have lived life based on what they thought everyone else expected they had to do, and not necessarily what they authentically wanted to do. Can I tell you a quick story about that? I was thinking of time. One of the early people that we did this therapy with was a man in his, he was 69, I think, and his life ambition was to become a QC. And he had just become a QC. He'd been living with cancer for about 4 years, and the last sort of treatment just didn't work, and he'd been announced that he was going to be a QC, and then it was clear that he wasn't going to be able to keep working. So he worked for a week as a QC. And he was asked to come and see me because he was really struggling. And, you know, he was mildly amused that he was going to come and talk to me about his feelings. But pleasantly surprised when I didn't necessarily want him to tell me how he was feeling about his life coming to an end. I wanted to know who he was and what had happened in his life and what was meaningful in his life. And so he told me the story of how he had been, he was the son of another lawyer. Okay? There's been a long line of lawyers in his family. And the expectation was always that he was going to be a lawyer. And we talked about this idea of joy. He achieved everything on paper, very successful man. Had a house in Canterbury, all his daughters had gone to a private school, he had three daughters, they were all married. He had achieved everything you would think on paper was a great thing to achieve. So when I talked to him about joy and when did he feel his first real joy, he told me the story about how as a child he was sent to boarding school quite young, and he never, in his words, recovered from being sent to boarding school and didn't quite understand why. His parents lived in the city. But during the holidays he would go down to the beach house, which belonged to his family, and that was his times of great joy because he was with his mum and it was a family thing. And so when we were kind of thinking about when was the time he could imagine feeling that sense of peace that I was describing to him, it was watching the boat builders down on the beach when he was a boy. And he said to me in passing, you know, I always wanted to be a boat builder. And I said, you know, did you think maybe you know, went into engineering or did that thing make you obviously don't know my family. It never, ever occurred to him that was an option, that anything was an option other than becoming a lawyer, and he did that very well. And he would say, don't get me wrong, that has served me well, we have had a great life. But we talked quite a bit about these kind of his experiences of joy being down at the beach. And after, I think, the third session that we did, he came and he said, we've made a decision, and we had I had a dinner with the family. He called it the Last Supper, which I thought was unhelpful for his children. And so they had a big dinner party, and he said, we want to tell you, Mother and I have decided we're going to move to the beach house, which is still in the family. So we're going to take also a couple of other things we talked about that he loved, his books, which he had read, a lot of them he had read, and his wine collection. So they're going to move the books and the wine down to the beach house, and they were going to move down there. He had a lot of regrets about missing out on his daughter's childhood because he worked so much. And he said, and the other thing is, and so if we want you to come down anytime you want and spend time with us, and we're going to be there, and that's you know what we're going to do. And I'm going to build a boat, and I want to build it with my grandkids and you girls and whoever wants to come and build a boat. Now it was a dinghy. You know, he built a yacht, but he built his boat. And what we talked about was him finally doing what authentically was him, and the joy that can bring. And all of us have those things. They might not need to be as big as that. And some people I know got to do that with their life, got encouraged that even though they were a musician, they were never going to make money, that they still, that's what was in them to do. And a lot of you may well have got to do it. You know, got to have a whole lot of the things in your life that you wanted. But if there are things that really do bring you joy and meaning, it's a great time to start working on those in your life. I digress a bit there. All right. So this model came from the research that we've been doing, and I'll try and unpack it for you a bit. So We interviewed 100 cancer patients at all different stages. We actually grabbed them while they were having chemotherapy, which was terrible because they were unable to say no. And we asked them to fill out a whole lot of measures around three areas that we knew, because we'd done a whole lot of interviews before then, were important. And so I'm just going to focus first of all on that little purple bit, which I'd love to lay claim to, but of course it's a triadic model that is ancient, and we see it in Christian tradition, we see it in Celtic tradition a whole lot. it's the Trinity. So we knew that suffering, meaning, and coping is the kind of stuff you just do during the day to get by, was important, but we wanted to understand exactly how these things worked. And what we found was that people who are living with cancer have more suffering, so we measured suffering in terms of physical problems, emotional pain, a whole lot of different levels of suffering, and more meaning, so those things I'm just talking to you about, than the general population. Both those things are higher. They happen simultaneously. And when I was trying to draw this, and a dear friend of mine who is Irish, she said, I think it looks like this. The reason why we draw it like this is because people move in and out of these phases. So if you have someone who is having a lot of pain when they wake up every morning. So they wake up in the morning and they're in the middle of treatment and they wake up in pain and they think, I can't do this anymore. I open my eyes and I'm in pain. So they're right in the middle of the suffering. And then someone they love comes in and says, come on, let's get you up. You need to take your pain medication. And you know when you're going to shower, you feel better, and you can come to tea or whatever it is. So that's in the coping part, doing what you need to do to manage the suffering. And then a friend rings and says, if we walk down Bulleen Road, we will catch the last leaves that are just about to fall. And it's a really sunny day. So let's go for a walk. And the person feels really loved and they're in meaning. So it's really normal to move in and out of these phases. It's normal for all of us to, but certainly heightens, I think, when you're in the middle of cancer treatment, for example. And the first thing to say about that is often people feel like they're not coping because they're moving in and out of these phases. They say, I'm all over the place, carry on. You know, yesterday I didn't live anymore. Today I'm so grateful I've got my grandchildren. I'm all over the place. And they go, no, does it look like this? Okay, so this is really normal. And it's normal because we are, as human beings, we're driven to make meaning and find meaning. So even when you read Holocaust accounts, people that are in the most horrific situation, they will still tell you about that little weed that they saw growing in the crack of one of the buildings. And they saw it and thought, gosh, that's so green, and that reminds me of being in the field. Okay? As a human being, we are driven to find that meaning. And so we move in, even when we're in that suffering, we move in and out. And one of the things that we do in the therapy that we're working on at the moment is we say, how can you be more in the meaning? How can you actually make that happen more so that it's more balanced? Now, the green circle came from the study that we did because we wanted to understand, so what holds people in that, when you're in that all over the place space? And what we know is that there are three really important things. The first one is that you've got your physical symptoms managed. So we know that if you're in pain, you've got a headache, you can't stop vomiting, all this goes out the window. So that's the first thing that has to be dealt with properly. And we know that if you have more meaning in life, you cope better. Might not live longer. We don't know what the other responses are, but you will cope better with everything if you have more meaning in life. But the other really important thing is connection, that you feel like you belong and matter to someone else or a whole group of people. If I could build a community around everyone, we will be halfway there, because people cope with anything when they feel loved and like they matter. And so in terms of how do we build ourselves up, we focus on those three areas. We make sure that we're doing what we need to do physically. We're dealing with the fatigue or lymphedema or whatever it is that's still hanging around. We certainly focus on the people that are important in our life. It doesn't have to be hundreds of people, but that those connections are really important, connections with other people. And we make sure that we've got meaning in life. And so we've talked about cognitive meanings and kind of making sense of things. And the way that you answer the question of how do I make sense of this tells a lot about what you're thinking about it. I take life as it comes, whatever comes, I just deal with it, or I can't believe this has happened.
or I can't believe that this has happened after everything else. Honestly, this is a way of taking back control. I get lots of different responses to that question. Interesting for you to think about how would you answer that question, because it will tell you a lot about how you view life. When you're most at peace or brings joy, when do you have most joy? Could be when I'm at the beach, when I see the sky, when I'm in the hospital, when I'm outside, whatever it is. Good to answer that question as well. And of course, the social meaning, the people that are around you. This is a quote: being deeply loved by someone gives you strength, while loving someone deeply gives you courage. So we're not talking just about accepting care and love. We know that actually looking after people makes us feel great as well. So it's that two-way street. Another learning: I sat upon the seesaw upon the lower end. I will rise to the skies when I find it. Okay. This is my final slide. You might find it a little weird. So the question is, where would you put cancer in your life and where would you like it? So you might think that's strange, and I would like, because it's been filmed, to keep your words plain about this, because where you like it. because it might be that you feel, well, cancer's not in my life anymore because I've treated it, but I will say that all of you are sitting here, so it is in your life to some extent. And one of the things that I've done with people is had a, remember phone books? That we still, some of us still have them around, but anyway, phone books, and I speak books, and I won't get any of you to come up because it's putting me too much embarrassment, but I give them the phone book and I say, this is your cancer. So tell me where it is. Now, for some women that we've done this with, they say it's here on my shoulders. I can carry it around with me. Or it's in a backpack. No, I'm still carrying it around. Or it's on the floor next to me. I'm not carrying it anymore, but it still follows me. You know, it's just around. Or it's just outside that door. Or wherever it is. Really interesting for you to think, where is it for you? It's something that you carry as part of who you always will be. Is it something that has nothing to do with your life anymore, or is it, where is it? Is it just over there a little bit? And then the question is, where would you like it to be? So, you know, I'm still carrying it, and I can't pretend that I've been through this experience, but I'd like it to be just on the floor now, out of my hands, so I'm not heavy anymore. Or I'd like it to be, I'd like to bury it in the garden and have some beautiful tree grow out of it. Or whatever it is. Now, obviously, this is just a metaphor, but it's an important one to think about. You know, where is it? You're still carrying it in some way, and is there a way you can put it somewhere? I'm not pretending that I have a crystal ball to know what outcomes are going to be for any of us in this room. So I'm not suggesting that it is easy to just go, well, it's not here anymore. But I am suggesting that you don't have to carry it in such a heavy way. If there is a place you can put it that feels more comfortable, then start thinking about how you can do that. Okay, I'm going to stop talking for a minute. I'd love any of your thoughts or responses to any of this. Okay, I'm really aware of time, so I'm going to wrap up, but I will hang back if things have been left. So thank you so much for coming, and I hope you got something eventually to take away, and best of luck in the next few months. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan Podcasts or browse existing podcasts by visiting www.brecan.org.au.